Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
In 1980, the workplace comedy 9 to 5 killed at the box office. It made more than $100 million, second only to The Empire Strikes Back. There was just something about the movie that connected with people at the time. It was this pointed and farcical portrayal of the experiences of women in clerical jobs at the time, the millions of secretaries and typists and administrative assistants. The actor Jane Fonda got the project going. She worked with her producing partner Bruce Gilbert and the director Colin Higgins to tell a story that reflected the struggle of women to be paid fairly, to be treated with dignity and have better working conditions. But the script they were working with, at first anyway, wasn't right. It was too heavy, too earnest. But then something happened to change the direction and the fate of the movie. This story is told in a documentary. Here's the director, Camille Hardman.
So they went to the National Office for Women Workers, and
we got about 40 women together from the 9 to 5 National Association of Women Office Workers, and they went around in a circle and they told their story.
It was a very stiff and stilted conversation.
Colin was very much a researcher, and it was very imperative to him to meet the women who he was doing a story about. And I've spoken to Bruce about this scene many, many times. And Bruce said it was very hard for the women to open up to them because, you know, they sort of were a little bit skeptical. Also, they were Hollywood coming in. How were they going to be portrayed? And also just having two men in the room, you know, and opening up about their experiences, you know, I think particularly in the 70s as well, was a somewhat scary experience in front of men.
And just when the meeting was about to end, Colin said, "Do any of you ever fantasize what you'd like to do to your boss?"
It then relaxed everybody in the room. They could then have candid conversations afterward because everybody had this moment together.
One woman wanted to cut her boss up in little pieces and put him in the coffee grinder and then put him in the coffee machine and have him drip out.
Put rat poison in his coffee.
One woman wanted to shred her boss in a paper shredder.
I could laugh. Colin could laugh as men in this room full of women listening to their very visual fantasies about doing in their bosses in very graphic, almost cartoonish ways.
Looks like you've gotten yourself in a spot of trouble.
They really wanted to find the story. That was the thing. You know, where was the in? Where was the story? Where was the hook? And when they discovered those fantasies, it was like, oh, this was the way that they could traject, you know, the rest of the film. It was those moments everybody could relate to, whether you were a man or a woman. There was always a boss that was above you somewhere that would do something to you, and everybody would sit in their seat and have some form of fantasy of what they wanted to do to them. And it was a broad, humorous moment too that everybody could relate to.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Camille Hardman's documentary is called Still Working 9 to 5. It's about the movie 9 to 5 and also the working conditions for women that inspired it. This is the latest in our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We're going to be screening it tonight at the downtown Salt Lake City Library. We'll have more details about that later. Hardman told us what got Jane Fonda started with this idea for the movie. It came from a social crusader and labor organizer named Karen Nussbaum.
One day, Karen had said to Jane, you know, I work in an office. She was working at Harvard at the time as a secretary. She had, you know, experienced certain things. And she was talking to a lot of other secretaries. They would have these lunches, you know, secretaries at other offices. And it was like, hey, let's have a lunch and let's talk about you know, issues at work or just a certain level of disrespect. And the disrespect could come in many, many forms. Hmm. You know, some of it was, you know, sort of sexual harassment. Some of it was just not knowing what the job description was. Some was just being treated like a complete idiot. So when Karen started telling Jane that, you know, she was having these lunches and she'd sort of started this, you know, very sort of, you know, loose sort of organization, Jane was like, oh, that could be a really good idea. Why don't you send us some information? The information she did send was mainly just data. It was statistics. It was like how many women are in the workforce. And Jane was like, okay, this is a great idea. But it was also Bruce Gilbert, the producer of 9to5, that really ran with it, because Bruce could see that there could be a very funny film made out of this concept, but they had to do a lot more research.
Yeah. I just wanted to mention that the documentary you've made isn't just about the issues of, you know, equality in the workplace. It's a profile of the movie 9to5 as a, you know, as a piece of art, how it was created and how it was structured. And as you say, two of the driving figures, of course, getting 9to5 made were Jane Fonda and the producer, Bruce Gilbert. Will you talk a little bit about their relationship? They were both, you know, kind of social activists who wanted, I guess, what, to use art to persuade people and make change. Is that a way to put it?
Yeah, I think Bruce and Jane were activists and they met through social activism. I think Bruce actually pitched the idea of, you know, hey, let's do some stories together. And he was a budding screenwriter, and let's produce films, because they realized that if the messages that they wanted to get out there, they had, and to get to a wide audience, this is the thing, you always, in social activism, the biggest things you want to do is not just preach to the converted. You want to try and show the widest audience you possibly can the issues that are really important. So people aren't just seeing either the propaganda that's being, you know, given to them or what they're reading or what they're hearing. It's like, you know, here is another perspective, but sometimes it's very hard to reach a wide audience. So in order to do that, they were like, okay, the art or the films we're going to create, they have to have some form of emotional engagement.
Yeah. Jane says in the film, they have to be embedded in a style.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And the style is, you know, a romance, a comedy. Mm-hmm. In some ways, they took formulas that were tried and true and successful and put a social activist spin on them. And they were incredibly successful. Coming Home was very, very poignant. It was a very emotive film, and people related to both of those characters. Then there was, I mean,
The China Syndrome.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
China Syndrome. I mean, that was a fabulous film. I think I was probably 8 or 9 when that came out, and I would hear my parents talk about it. I remember, I think, even a teacher talking about, you know, the China Syndrome and the impact of nuclear power and what that meant and explaining what nuclear power was. And again, you know, the average person would never have talked about those issues if it had not been in a film and if they had not emotionally engaged with that film.
Yeah. Okay, so Coming Home, that was about the war in Vietnam, deeply dramatic film. China Syndrome, a thriller about the dangers of nuclear power. How did they choose to take the serious issue of equality for women in the workforce and make that a comedy? How does that happen?
It was, you know, probably Bruce who really looked at this and thought, we have a film about secretaries. We know at this point it would be great to have Lily Tomlin, you know, Jane Fonda and Dolly Parton, you know, and that was sort of like this loose cast that Jane, she was the one that really chose those three. So looking at that, it was like, you know, we want to do a social commentary, and how are we going to do that? So Hal Hartley used to have these film nights. And he used to screen a lot of Preston Sturges films. Hmm. And Bruce used to go along to these Hal Hartley nights and saw these films, and then just this light bulb went off in his head, and he was like, we have to do it like a Preston Sturges film, a social commentary with a comedic spin where you can have situations that, again, are very relatable to people, that are funny, but you are not overly criticizing individuals or, you know, saying all bosses are bad. You know, some bosses could look at this and see themselves, but again, you're not being overly critical, even though there's an underlying narrative where people know that how these women are being treated is bad.
It seems like there's this kind of turning point in the film when this man by the name of Colin Higgins comes into the process. He, as you say, before had written the very classic film Harold and Maude. And let's talk a little bit about why he was so important for the project. He had this vision that was farcical. Someone in the film says it was kind of slapsticky. You mentioned earlier the idea of treating it as if it was this fantasy of working women in offices all over the country. But it seems like he was really important to sort of shaping something that wasn't dark, but was edgy, I guess. How do you explain it?
I mean, you couldn't get more edgier than Harold and Maude, could you?
Yeah,
I watched that again the other day, and I was like, this is just brilliant. Colin Higgins obviously had this absolute talent with comedy. I think the thing that Colin did is he understood American audiences. He understood how comedy can resonate with people and open their minds. A lot of people don't really understand and can't do that. And I think that was his real talent. With every film that he did, he was able to really touch people. And as I said before, you know, that's how Colin was able to get all those women around the table, all those secretaries around the table to open up, because he understood once you connect with someone, you're able to get them to think about things differently.
Camille Hardman, she's a director along with Gary Lane of the documentary called Still Working 9 to 5. You can join us for a screening of the film tonight at 7 at the Downtown Salt Lake City Library. We'll have details for that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the 1980 comedy 9 to 5. Here's how Jane Fonda pitched the idea to the movie studio. It's about secretaries fantasizing about murdering their bosses. These were real fantasies based on real stories from women suffering the indignities of the clerical workforce in the 70s and 80s. There's a documentary that uses 9 to 5 to tell the larger story of women and work, and it's the latest film in our series with the Utah Film Center. The documentary is called Still Working 9 to 5. We're going to be screening it tonight at the Downtown Salt Lake City Library. We have with us today one of the directors of the film, Camille Hardman. Let's talk about how all of the actors come to be part of all of this. Tell the story as you do in the film, of how Jane Fonda starts thinking about involving Dolly Parton. It's a nice little kind of moment of serendipity. I think she hears her on the radio and it gives her an idea.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, she was actually coming home from watching Lily Tomlin do her one-woman show.
Well, Jane came to see me at the Amundsen. I was doing Appearing Nightly, which was my first Broadway show. And I was really excited that she was coming to the show, and she came backstage. And I'd been a fan of hers for many years.
Just had blown my mind and made me feel that I don't want to make a movie about women office workers if Lily Tomlin isn't one of them. I was smitten.
Boogie's not a meaning, boogie is a feeling. Don't try to understand it. Try to feel it. Do you feel it?
And then true story. I was driving home from that event, and I turned on the radio. It was Dolly Parton singing Two Doors Down. I thought, wow, she's never been in a movie. But I bet she can be herself on camera, and herself is so multi-layered and interesting that that would be just fine.
She was like, oh, wow, could you imagine Dolly as the boss's personal secretary, just her in all her sort of, you know, visual glory and not being able to see her fingers as she's typing. And she was just like, you know, she would be the perfect choice because Dolly's banter, you know, is she's very quick-witted. She is very funny. I mean, she can be a comedian herself. If you go and watch her early concerts, she is so funny. And then the more that I also watched her on talk shows, she is so fast and she is so quick that half the time those guys were spinning around. She would just come out with things and they were like, they didn't even have a retort because she was so quick.
As you say, she's very quick-witted. She's very bright. She has her own kind of sense of what's right and what's wrong. But the thing that comes out in the documentary is that she was a little worried about, you know, she was a country music singer, so she was worried about being too political. As she says, she didn't want to march up and down the street, that she advocated for the things she believed in her songs. Maybe say a little bit about her approach to activism, because this was new, and she was a little, I don't know, maybe a little worried about what this would mean, acting in this film.
I think we have to remember a time when Jane Fonda was the most hated woman in America. And I still see remnants of that. We get the most vitriolic comments on our social media when we do any posts with Jane. I still find it absolutely shocking. So when you have someone like Jane who is seen as a American pariah in many ways, but on the other hand, was also seen as a hero. She was one extreme or the other. And Dolly, in many ways, was from a place where Jane was seen as the American anti-hero. And that was her audience base. Yeah. And for her to suddenly be in a film with Jane Fonda, that would, you know, either make or break her career. And it was something that she had to think about.
Well, when I first started, I thought, no, I hope she's not going to be so radical and so opinionated and so political that I'm going to be uncomfortable. And I even said that to her. You know, when we started, I said, now, I'm not a political person.
My mistakes are no worse than yours just because I'm a woman.
I didn't have to march up and down the streets as I still don't. I try to live my convictions. I'd been writing songs about women and their strengths since my first album.
So it was a big decision to make, but as we all know, Dolly is a woman with a mind of her own, and she will do what she thinks is right and what is morally acceptable for her and her family. And she made a decision that she was going to work with Jane, who is a fabulous actor, and at that time, Dolly was also expanding her career. She also wanted to get into the mainstream. You know, she was a country western music, you know, singer, and she always had a bigger vision for herself, and she wanted to be a full-blown star. And she saw this as a vehicle where that could happen. She's with a movie star, yes, maybe the anti-hero, but still a very successful movie star that she could learn from. And then with also one of the best comedians in the world. Yeah. And why wouldn't she?
Lily Tomlin turned the role down when it was first offered to her. When she did finally take it up, she, after the first day, she thought she needed to get out of her contract. There's a good bit of Lily just being really conflicted about how she felt about this film. Say a little bit about Lily Tomlin's role in all of this.
I think at that time, her star was on the rise as well. I mean, she was a very well-known TV comedian. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she was still making her way sort of up the film star sort of ranks. And Lily was a little bit more of probably an intelligent comedian. And so for her, some of the script, you know, that Colin wrote, again, this is the thing we were talking about before, that Colin, you know, it was very good with broad humor. And sometimes broad humor can be a little silly.
Well, I was living in New York at the time. And I didn't like some of the humor in the 9 to 5 script, so I turned it down at first. There were, you know, things in it that I would consider kind of silly or empty. Like when we were drinking in the bar after work.
Would you two show a little spunk? I mean, what are you, a man or a mouse? I mean, a woman or a louse?
When Lily Tomlin turns down your script and tells you it's not very good, you start to worry because she's such a comedic genius that you begin to think, what am I not seeing in this script? What is she seeing?
I said, first man or a mouse, and then I say woman or a louse. I don't know. That's just sort of foolish rhyming. And so I tried to get Colin to change that. And my partner Jane said, you threw that script back in Jane Fonda's face. She developed that movie for you and Dolly. What is wrong with you? I don't know. I don't know.
The linchpin for her making the decision was when it was offered to Gilda Radner, which was her fellow comedian on Saturday Night Live. And she was like, oh my God, Gilda can't get this. I'd never forgive myself if she, you know, her career took off. And that was the one that really, you know, drew her in and to say yes. But then, you know, once she was on the set, here's Lily all dressed up in this Snow White outfit, being told that she had to, it was the scene in the office where all the birds were tweeting around her, the animated birds, and they were all cardboard cutouts. And she's jumping around in this Snow White outfit in the office amongst these cardboard cutouts. And she was like, oh, this is ridiculous. Like, what am I doing? You know, this is absolutely absurd. I don't want to be a part of this film, you know. And she ran off to Bruce and said, I can't do this film. You have to take me out. Whatever you need to do. You don't have to pay me. You know, you can just take me off.
Those 24 hours when Lily Tomlin said she thought she should quit the film or that I should release her from the film because her performance wasn't up to snuff, well, you know, was one of those moments, especially since Lily Tomlin was so key to playing the demented Snow White, and she had turned the project down once before. I saw my life flashing before my eyes just the first day of shooting in the film, and one of the lead actresses wants to quit the picture.
Eventually, he was able to, you know, calm Lily down and talk her into doing the next day. And then, as Bruce says, you know, what I've worked out with Lily, her first reaction isn't always the best reaction, and just to let it sit, and then the next day everything will be fine.
Right. We should talk about Dabney Coleman and the part he plays, because there's a good bit of discussion in the documentary about how an actor should play comedy. Coleman absolutely nails it as an actor, and it's interesting because in the film, he's a complete bastard, but he's somehow likable. Talk about the part he plays.
He's even lovable, which is even worse. I think Dabney, being from Texas, really understood those characters and knew those type of men. I think his portrayal was just brilliant. Like, he just nailed the misogyny every single time. There was something about him that was still innocent. There was an innocence to that character. It doesn't matter how horrible he was. You felt that if he had only been taught another way, he may not be like that. And I think he and Dolly had a really good rapport. And I think that's also what made those scenes so real, because they both had grown up in that environment. So they knew how far they could push it without offending people and remaining humorous and seeing the reality to that behavior.
Morning.
Dabney and I had such fun reversing roles.
Turn around for a second. Oh, you got a nice ass frame.
No wonder we were all scared to death to work with this dynamo. She's frightening.
I got to do what Mr. Hart had been doing to us girls in the office.
Boy, that's great cologne you're wearing, Frank.
Oh, thank you.
That stuff's turning me on. What's that called?
Stud.
Stud!
How did this film fit into, I guess, what you could describe as the, you know, American culture wars at the time? Because one of the things that, you know, that we hear in the documentary is women on the street saying they didn't want to be identified as feminists necessarily. They didn't necessarily want to be pegged with the women's liberation movement, but they did want to be treated equally, and they did want to be treated with respect. So how did that work?
Feminism in the 70s could be seen as very staunch. It was a lot of women finally going, I've had enough, and I'm going to fight for my rights. I'm going to go out on the streets. And it was very much entwined into the sexual liberation movement as well. And so there was a lot of bra burning. There was a lot of women also saying, not only do I deserve to be equal in the office and at work, but I also deserve to be sexually equal. And I think what happened is there were a lot of people, you know, traditional women who were like, we don't relate to that side of feminism, but we relate to the fact that we work and we deserve to get paid the same as a man doing the same job. We deserve to be respected. I need to speak up about this. I need the workplace to change. I don't necessarily want to go out and, you know, be sexually liberated, but I want to know that I am valued for the work that I do.
How do you explain the way people, audiences reacted? We see a part in the documentary where there were the reviews, and people were, I don't know, it's interesting that harmless good fun, you know, when it doesn't get on its high horse, it's mildly amusing, it's silly, but it really seemed to connect. How do you describe the reaction to it all?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do, it was three female leads in a film, which had never really happened before. And so that's also a big cultural shift. And at that time, you know, most of the reviewers were men. And right. So it was also like, hey, hang on a minute, why is this film doing so well with these three female leads? Like, this is just a silly film. It's silly humor. And you know, it wasn't taken seriously, at all. And, you know, and there are some parts of the film, I admit, that are silly, you know, once we get into the hospital scenes. But, you know, they are quite farcical, and there is a sense of ridiculousness. But it was probably a little bit concerning for some people. It was like, hey, this is another way to express feminism that isn't so overt. And it's subliminal, and this actually may be more effective.
So there's this kind of coda in the documentary that offers this kind of soaring sense of hope. We see Kamala Harris in 2020 become the, you know, vice president, and I'm wondering how it works now for people to see it in 2025. How does it work in the moment now, that coda of such kind of, as I said, you know, soaring, the kind of brilliant idea of the possible? Does it work differently in the moment we're in now?
You know, it's interesting. I saw the film again in front of an audience about a month ago in Texas. That last sentence where Dolly says, "We're only at the beginning," and Lily then says, "Yes, we're only at the beginning." To me, that was more poignant now than it was when our film first came out, because that is how I think a lot of women now feel, that Roe versus Wade was rolled back. We're seeing so many things being eroded, DEI, I, this whole thing about DEI, you know, a lot of people don't even understand what DEI is. You know, a lot of people think it's about trans rights, but they forget that it's also about veterans' rights. It's about disability. It's about women. It is a whole myriad and spectrum of people that fall under DEI. This is how I see DEI. Diversity is, there's a whole range of different people sitting at the table. Equity means that every single person at that table who is doing the same thing is getting paid the same way. And inclusion means that everybody who is sitting at that table feels like they're being heard. And women are very much a part of that. And not, you know, with childcare, they're also talking about taking away the very small tax subsidy that's there. You know, the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, has not been passed. You know, there's all of these things that we've all been fighting for a long time that everybody thought we were getting a point to, where everybody understood, we're all in it together. And now all these divisions are starting again. And I think that's the sad thing that's happening in America right now, is the division.
Camille Hardman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Camille Hardman, she's one of the directors of the documentary Still Working 9 to 5, which we're going to be screening tonight at 7 at the Downtown Salt Lake City Library. This is our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We have details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the impact of the 1980 blockbuster workplace comedy 9 to 5. There's a documentary that explores the creative process behind the movie and the real-life stories of the working women who inspired it. And there's actually one woman in particular who inspired 9 to 5, an activist and labor leader named Karen Nussbaum. In the 1970s, she co-founded an organization called 9 to 5, and the idea was to advocate for issues like fair pay and better working conditions and the protection from sexual harassment. Jane Fonda and others basically created their movie based on Nussbaum's template for activism. So we spoke with Nussbaum this week.
My parents always taught us to respect other people and not be mean. And so we really took that to heart. Yeah. And I was 18 in 1968, and the world was blowing up, and I knew it was my responsibility to be part of making positive change. And as I got active, I came to realize that you needed to not just stir things up, but you needed to anchor change in real organizations that people had control over, that people voted for and paid dues to and owned. And there were only, a handful of big institutions like that in our country, churches, the electoral party system, or unions. And I needed to work like most people, and I wanted to see what we could do to actually make unions the kind of responsible, responsive, important, powerful organizations for working people that they have been off and on over history.
So you were, at the time, this activist in the women's movement. You were active in the anti-war movement. And I guess you just figured, I'll take that kind of activism and bring it to my job. I'm as a clerical worker, basically.
Yeah, Doug, it was a lot less well thought out than that. It was, I needed to work. I needed to pay rent and go to the grocery store, just like everybody else. And in the late 60s and early 70s, there were only a few jobs that women typically got. And clerical work was the number one. One out of three women who were working were clerical workers, and I became one of them. I was a clerk typist. I had extremely limited responsibilities and very limited pay. I was also part of a wave of women entering the workforce at that time. I later came to discover that 12 million women entered the workforce in the 1970s in the U.S. Wow. And that was a big change. And they were all, we were all concentrated in just a handful of jobs. And so it meant you had working class women and middle class women, Black and white women, all in these offices together. It was a melting pot. We shared a lot of the same problems and ambitions. And we became friends and we talked to each other. And we did this all in the context of a really successful civil rights movement that had made a lot of changes and a surging women's movement. And so on the job, while I was busy doing my activism other places, I did come to realize that I had a job to support my organizing, but I could also organize on the job.
Right.
And it was kind of just falling into it and realizing that those same skills could be used in my own workplace.
One of the things you've talked about is that the way to organize, maybe the way to persuade people to get engaged, is to have this really open approach, to be willing to work with people who don't share your perspective or your politics necessarily. And you talked about that most women in that time wouldn't have really identified with the term feminist or the women's lib movement necessarily. So at least initially you wanted to stay away from that term because you didn't want it to be kind of a hurdle for women getting engaged. Will you talk a little bit about that as a, I don't know if it was a tactic that you strategized, but it seemed like a value that was important to you.
Many of us who started 9to5, there were 10 of us who met every week to talk about the issues. We were friends. We were all working in different kinds of workplaces, doing clerical work. We knew that this would only work if it was really broad, that if we broke out of what was being seen as the women's movement and had already its own backlash, we could see in our own workplaces that women liked the ideas of women's equality a lot, but they were afraid of the image that was being served up to them of what the women's movement was. So we wanted to create our own wing of the women's equality movement. And we used to say, don't let your words be the enemy of your ideas. And so when we would go have recruitment lunches with women who had filled out a survey saying what they liked and didn't like about their jobs, they would almost always start by saying, I'm no women's libber, but I should be able to get a promotion or, you know, I shouldn't be have to get coffee for my boss. And so we never used the word feminist. I think in the 15 or 20 years that I was at 9to5, we never used the word feminist. We just built through experience and ambition a form of organizing that women could feel represented their approach and who they were and could let them grow.
You also seemed to have adopted this. You didn't take yourselves too seriously. I mean, there was a kind of, you made up funny songs. You had these bad boss contests. You did skits. And it's interesting because there's a kind of symmetry in the way you were doing all of this with what the movie 9 to 5 was trying to do. That is, I mean, Jane Fonda talks about this, that she wanted it to be a good movie, not a political screed. And she figured a comedy would just work best, not something dark. So it seems like you were kind of connected in that way. Was that something you thought a lot about? Just like, let's not take ourselves too seriously?
I wish I could say it was a big strategy. But right. I think it was also we had an innate sense that actually we didn't have that much power. Yeah. But comedy is a massive leverage for the powerless. You know, we knew that women would be with us if they could hear us, that the shortcut to that was through humor. And so we poked fun at the boss all the time, which was something that you weren't allowed to do in the workplace or you weren't allowed to do in public. Well, we just started doing it. And it also actually appealed to reporters. We would have 20 members go to some workplace and pillory a boss, and we would have every TV station there. We would get on the front page of the Boston Globe and every local newspaper when we had our pettiest office procedure contest.
Right.
And then we found that the bosses that we went after for outrageous things, a boss who required his secretary to sew his pants while he had them on, another boss who gave his secretary a pager, which is what we had in those days, to go to a local bar and cruise for him and let him know if there was a woman who met his specifications. We found that over a few years, because we were right, because women were discriminated against, because we were doing a lot of work for a little amount of pay and reinforcing a system that thrived on taking advantage of women and people of color, all of that was right, but it wasn't appealing as a screed. Yeah. But when you brought the elements of it to light with humor, people piled on.
There's this moment of revelation in the film where the filmmakers, they're trying to sort of work out themes for the film, and they're having this conversation, and it was – they got – 40 women together from the 9 to 5 association. And it, as it's described in the film, it was this really, at first, this really kind of stilted conversation. But then the idea changes. Colin Ferguson says, "Have you ever fantasized about what you want to do with your boss?" And that seemed to change everything. Those fantasies, which were a little dark, but were also kind of funny. So that sentiment, that seemed to be an important part and an important idea for the film. What do you make of that?
The meeting that the filmmakers had with 40 of our members in Cleveland really set the stage for the success of the movie in two ways. One is that it meant that all of the details that show up in the film come right out of direct experience of women workers. So it wasn't some writers making up what it was like to work in the office or what the issues were going to be. And it tapped into this fury that was under the surface almost everywhere. And the outrages in the film of the things that they want to do to the boss all come out of the very ideas that our members provided in Cleveland, with the exception, I think, of the hanging from a hook from the garage door.
Yeah. But
I attended many showings of the film. I would go to the opening nights in city after city, and I'd go see the film over and over. And the same thing would happen every time. People would going into the film because it had Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin and Dolly Parton. It was going to be a lot of fun. And maybe they were with their friends or husbands, boyfriends, whatever. And they'd sit down and just be looking for a fun evening. And then the film would start and the women were riveted. And, you know, and the boyfriends and the husbands are like, they're having a good time, but they're looking at the women next to them thinking something else is going on here. And it meant that 2 hours later, all these women came out of the theater, not looking for political education, but for them, an unknown question had been answered. And that unknown question was, is there really discrimination against women as workers? And that movie said, you bet there is, and it's outrageous. And those women were ready to move on to, well, what do you do about outrageous discrimination? The film is one of the best pieces of culture promoting cultural change, or political change. It's on the level of Modern Times by Charlie Chaplin in 1936, because it got the people right, and it was tied to an actually existing movement, which could then run with changed consciousness.
So, of course, the big question is, what has changed in the workforce for women from the 70s and 80s to now? And I'll have you sort of answer that question, but one of the sort of particular points I wanted to get you to talk about is something you've mentioned, is that you've talked about how women are individually more empowered and more self-reliant in the workforce, but collectively they're powerless. That's an important distinction. Do you mind talking about that?
Sure. What we learned from the 70s and the 80s, so many women, was how to become self-reliant. And women are really self-reliant now. Nobody believes that, well, actually times are changing, but the predominant view for women is that we have to take care of ourselves. We are, you know, part of families. That's awesome. But at the end of the day, we have to count on ourselves. And that was really important. It meant that you didn't have to think that you had no agency. But that self-reliance became personal in as we moved into the 90s and the 2000s. And it meant that while an individual woman could make changes in her life, maybe the power that only comes from collective action, the ability for a majority of workers to have a union in their workplace and force the boss to bargain with them or to collectively vote for candidates who are going to establish laws that create equality in the workplace, that was lost. The sense of collective power was just driven under through an all-out assault on the culture by big corporations in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. Women did see a closing in the pay gap between men's work and women's work, but half of that closing, half of it was women getting better jobs, half of it was men's jobs getting worse. That what we saw overall as a corporate strategy was not share the wealth, but it was put more pressure on wages and benefits for all workers and make men's jobs look more like the jobs that were traditionally held by women and people of color. And that's what we have today. We have jobs that don't even have work hours that you can rely on. We don't have pensions anymore. We don't have guaranteed sick days and vacation days. So what we have is a failure of the strength in numbers, and now we're paying for it.
Karen Nussbaum. She co-founded and was the first director of 9 to 5, the National Association for Working Women. She's featured in the documentary Still Working 9 to 5, which we're going to be screening tonight at the Downtown Salt Lake City Library. This is our partnership with the Utah Film Center. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West, or you can just send us an email if you want at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Katrina Cano, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.